This episode of TGC's Word of the Week is sponsored by Midwestern Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri. Midwestern's 81-hour residential Master of Divinity degree offers a complete foundation for a lifetime of fruitful ministry. For more information, visit mbts.edu/mdiv.
You don't have to be ashamed of your limp. All of us got one. Some are just more visible than the others. But they are tangible reminders that we've been with God and that God has not left us.
This is TGC's Word of the Week, a sermon podcast from the Gospel Coalition. This week's sermon, When God Leaves You with a Limp, was preached by Charlie Dates at Wheaton College on November the 2nd, 2017. The text is Genesis chapter 32, verses 22 through 32. Listen now to Charlie Dates on When God Leaves You with a Limp.
This morning, I want to tag our text and this exchange between a rock and a hard place. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. I was blind, but now I see. These words, which echo through the corridors of church history, were not written by someone who you and I at the time of the writing would regard as the most saintly person alive. Not by a saint like Mother Teresa or an amazing preacher like Charles Haddon Spurgeon, or by one of your not-so-known alumni named Billy Graham. But these words to this life-changing hymn were written by a slave trader, by one who was engaged in the transatlantic slave trade, and in fact, on a boat one day, when no small storm assailed the ship that he was on, the young writer of this hymn, John Newton, fell to his knees and pleaded with God for mercy. He prayed one of those, "If you get me out of here, God, I'll never do this again," kind of prayers. Maybe you've never prayed one of those prayers. I'll tell you, like my grandmother used to say to me, keep living. Life has a way of backing you into a corner where you know that the circumstance you're in is your fault, and you pray to God, "God, if you get me out of this, I'll never do it again." Well, that's what Newton prayed, and believe it or not, God stilled the storm. Bringing him out of that storm, Newton picked up his pen and wrote the words to Amazing Grace. It's an interesting window in terms of how God uses trouble to transform us. Dr. Freddie Haynes, the pastor of the Friendship West Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, says it this way, that God takes our adversity and turns it into a university where he uses trouble not to harm us, but to build us. That seems to be an interesting window and a great gateway to the passage which you and I heard read today. We meet Jacob in Genesis 32, taking a nap between two burned bridges. He has lived as a man on the run, almost out of the womb he was on the run. Coming out of his mother's womb, he was holding on to the heels of his brother Esau. He lived his life on the run, tricking his brother Esau out of his birthright for a bowl of bean soup. I could understand if it was chicken noodle soup, but bean soup, he got his brother out of his birthright. He then went on to trick his father into giving the covenantal blessing to transfer it from Isaac to Jacob instead of Esau, the elder son to whom it belonged. And then in conspiratorial instincts with his mother, he lived on the run again. He had to run to his uncle Laban's place, where he ends up meeting the love of his life, Rachel. But on a cool, dark wedding evening, he actually ended up with her sister, who, according to the Hebrew or the Akkadian, it's kind of hard to tell, she was hard on the eyes. Her name is Leah. And in the morning, the Bible says he was shocked to discover that instead of getting the woman who he had worked 7 years for, he ended up getting her sister. That's the kind of relationship he had with his father-in-law, Laban. He was a man who had used to trick people. Jacob was accustomed to getting over on people like a local car dealer, but it turns out that his father-in-law was a match for him. His father-in-law ended up tricking him. And after working another 7 years for Rachel, Jacob comes to discover that he will not have the kind of life promised to him living with Laban, and so he plans to leave. It's a kind of coup d'etat with sheep and goats. He spots all of the sheep and the goats, and he breaks away with the lion's share of the profit of his uncle Laban's place. And here Jacob is again on the run. This time he's running back south towards Seir, and he is going to encounter Esau, his brother. And this isn't the kind of family reunion you want to go to in the south during the summer. This is a kind of ugly family reunion, the kind where the last words Esau utters on the pages of scripture is, "The next time I see my brother, I'm going to kill him." Knowing these things, Jacob is now caught having to run at night, knowing he will run into his brother, knowing he cannot go back to his uncle. And here God meets him at the ford of Jabbok. This is an interesting season of Jacob's life. And in this moment, as Jacob has just crossed his family across the ford, having tread the water at night, a dangerous, difficult, and dark trek, he comes up for air to lay his head upon a stone. When that evening, exhausted, wet, fatigued, emotionally distressed, out of nowhere, an unidentified assailant picks Jacob up at night, throws him down to the ground, and begins to wrestle with him until daybreak. Now, this isn't that WWF wrestling I grew up watching with Macho Man Randy Savage or Hulk Hogan. I know that's before your time. This isn't that WWE fake choreographed wrestling. No, the word in the original language literally means that they were kicking up dust. Here is Jacob in the throes of hand-to-hand combat with someone he does not know, he does not recognize. But what he understands very quickly is this man is more powerful than he is. Can you see Jacob there at night on the side of the ford of Jabbok wrestling with this man for his life? When he realizes he cannot overpower the man, he simply starts to hold on to the man. After holding on to the man says, "Well, let me go. I can't be seen in these parts." When day breaks, we did not know, Jacob did not know who this man was. But when ESPN shows up at the end of this fight, we learn in the post-interview fight that this is none other than a pre-incarnate sighting of Jesus Christ, a theophany. It turns out Jacob was wrestling with God. One of the ways in which we know that Jacob was wrestling with God is because God touched him and dislocated his thigh. And it is at that point, while Jacob is holding on to God, that God says, "Let me go." And Jacob says, "I can't let you go because I recognize there's something about you that I need. There's something you have that I need from you. I won't let you go until you bless me." To which the reply comes, "Well, what's your name?" And Jacob admits his failure in his name, and his name is changed. And he goes from being simply the trickster shyster Jacob to being Israel, one who struggles with God and wins. All of that to say this to you, my friends, this morning at Wheaton. We win with God by losing. There is in this room tonight, unknown today, unknown potential. Many of you will go on to places where you will have an opportunity to change the world, to reach your neighborhood, your family, and your friends. But I want to tell you today that you will not win in life by being stubborn with God, by being self-reliant or self-sufficient, by clinging on to the things you want. The only way you win with God is by losing to God. I know in a gathering of this size, somebody here today has to be struggling with God. God may not come down in time and space to wrestle with us in the way that he did with Jacob, but you can feel like your life is in the throes. I want to pass on to you today a few things that'll help you to surrender to God and to experience the great fulfillment of his plan for your life. After all, God is up to something great in you. And if you are going to experience the magnitude of the potential he has placed in your life, then there are some things you need to know about God. It turns out that Genesis chapter 32, verses 22 through 32, is an answer to prayer. Jacob has been praying, saying to the Lord, "You promised me some things, and I'm looking for the fulfillment of these things. I'm wondering if you will deliver me from my brother Esau." But it is amazing when we read the narrative of verses 22 through 32 that God does deliver Jacob, but he does not deliver him from Esau. He delivers Jacob from himself. You need to know this about God, that God will prearrange calculated opportunities of life for you, where he will bring you to your knees in your low moments so that you can see that he is God and you are not. This, friends, is a word about how God meets us in our low moments. You may not catch it from a cursory reading, but here at the fort of Jabbok, in verse 22, is one of the geographical low places, a steep ravine near the Dead Sea and the Jordan River of that ancient Mesopotamian metropolis. This, friends, is a low moment, a place for Jacob where he never thought he would settle. Not only is he in a low place geographically, he's in a low place physically. I don't know if any of you have ever had to be responsible for anyone other than yourself. But seeking to teach me a strong work ethic, my mother made me get a summer job working for the Chicago Park District when I was in high school, where I was a rec leader and when I was responsible for more than 10 little boys in the first grade. It was my job to see to it that those parents got their kids back to them safe and sound every day. I remember going on field trips, Dr. Ryken, and to the Museum of Science and Industry, and my regular activity, every 10 minutes on the 8, I would be counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 minutes would pass again. I'd be counting hits. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I did that so much that during my naps in the afternoon, I'd be counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Came home exhausted, having to look after a few people. Here is Jacob with a company. 2 wives. 1 is enough. 2 wives, multiple children, they're handmaids. And how does he get them across the ford of the Jabbok? There are no bridges. There are no lights, no street lights. There are no GPS things on his smartphone to guide him safely through. He has to tread water with his young children to get his cattle across. He is wet. He is exhausted. He is emotionally drained. He has left his crazy father-in-law and is now about to meet his slightly deranged, perhaps, brother in a few moments. And on top of that, he's facing the difficulty of his life. And it is at this moment, when the text reads in verse 4, that Jacob was left alone. Watch that. Don't miss that, friends. This is the very place where God often meets you and I. And in our world today, with earbuds in our ear everywhere we go, podcasts everywhere, friends in every locale, it's actually hard to get alone. He is alone in this passage with his disconcertions, alone with his regrets, alone with his life story, alone pondering the future. And when it seems like he is alone, it turns out he's not alone at all. I feel my help in this place. Y'all don't mind if I raise my voice a bit. I want to say to you that this often is how God works. When it seems like you are alone, when it seems like you are at the end of your resources, when you are at a place where there is no one else there, let me remind you that there is someone else there. And he is there working for you, speaking to you, and bringing about his wonderful plan for your life. Friends, I want to suggest to you that if you want to experience the transformation of God, if you want to experience him bringing your full potential to play in your life, don't spend every waking moment with someone else. But learn how to get by yourself, to fall on your knees, to open a hymn book, and to cry out unto the Lord and watch God meet you in that space. Here, God meets Jacob in a way to fulfill his plan. And he's working on Jacob because the problem is not with Esau. The problem is not with Laban. The problem was not with Jacob's mother or Jacob's father. The problem was with Jacob. And I bring it up today because for many of us, as we ask God to be at work in our lives to bring about the fulfillment of the potential he has placed in us, the problem is not our business, our school, our work, or one day our marriages. That's not the problem for God to fulfill his potential in our lives. The problem often is us. When you are alone, in your low moments, God does some of his great work. But I want to encourage you as well in this passage. When you look at verses 25 to 26, pay attention to the way Jacob fights with God. This is something you might not feel like you need today, but take it like a pearl and tuck it away in the pocket of your heart. When moments of life arise, listen, when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." This is interesting because by now you and I, having listening to the sermon, know who this one is who's fighting with Jacob. And the text says that when he saw he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. This is almost suggesting that God couldn't beat Jacob. Do you feel that tension in the text? How does God not beat Jacob? Think about it. How does God not beat any of us? Surely it's not because God is weak or Jacob is so strong. No, I think God did to Jacob what I sometimes do with my children. Oh, for the joy for many of you to have many children. May you be fruitful and multiply and populate the earth. It's a wonderful thing. Come home, my 6-year-old son, who will likely be with me tomorrow morning. From time to time, he'll want to fight. He'll want to play. And I want him to be tough. I don't want him to be soft. I want him to be tough. But that's my own bias. Pardon me. That's my own bias. I want him to be tough. And so we fight. Now, at any given moment, I can break him. I can pick him up and I can slam him down. That'll be the end of the fight. He hates losing, by the way. And so one of the things that I do is I don't want to crush his confidence, so I don't make him lose right away. And then in a joyful moment, he'll come and grab me and tackle me, and I'll fall down, and I'll declare him the winner, to which he's very pleased about, and his mother is too. You know how he wins? He wins because I let him win. He wins because I love him, and I want to see him victorious. He does not win because I cannot win. He wins because I'm trying to build something in him. Friends, this is how God could not prevail against Jacob. It's because God let Jacob win. God was trying to build something in Jacob, to take something out of Jacob. And God lets Jacob overpower him so that Jacob can be considered the victor. Isn't that interesting? God could have made him the victim, but instead he lets him become the victor. And in the same way, God works with you and I. He could take us down. He fights with us and he beats us. But when he finished beating us, he declares that we beat him. Watch how Jacob wins. Jacob holds on to God. He discovers that he cannot win. His thigh, his hip is dislocated. He cannot fight much anymore. And in this moment, when he cannot wrestle or fight much, he simply starts to cling to the one who he's wrestling with. Oh, how I wish I had my church right in this moment. He is holding on. He cannot wrestle or fight. He simply holding on. Now, this is a wonderful picture of my daughter in this sense. She knows she can't win. She'll just hold on until I'm tired and say, okay, you got me. You're good. But I think, friends, in this text, this is what God had wanted Jacob to do all along. You see, all of Jacob's life, he had been fighting and cheating and manipulating and scheming and conniving, trying to get something that God had always wanted him to have. Jacob is trying to manipulate his way into the will of God. It was God's plan for Jacob to be the leader. It was God's plan through whom the blessing of the world would come through Jacob. But Jacob is wrestling his whole life trying to fight for something that already God has planned to come to him. And I want to suggest to you and I that God all along simply wanted Jacob to hold on to him. Don't hold on to your pride. Don't hold on to your resources. Don't hold on to your schemes. Simply hold on to me, this text suggests. But at the end of it, as we're at the end of our time, we see that God leaves Jacob with a limp.
We got 5 more minutes.
I got you. It's going to take 5. God leaves Jacob with a limp. He's working some things out of him, working some things into him, but he leaves Jacob with an unmistakable mark that Jacob has been in a fight with God. In other words, for the rest of his life, Jacob will bear the insignia of having been with God. When people see him walk, limping, they think it may be a handicap, but it's actually a blessing. They think it may be something meant to slow him down, but it's something God intended to help him savor and enjoy life. Friends, I want to suggest to you that limps did not stop in Genesis 32. They're still happening in 2017. My guess is some of you here today have a limp. Maybe your limp has come as a result of sexual promiscuity. But the fact that you're still walking is a reminder that God is at work in your life. Maybe your limp has come from a broken family or a broken marriage. But the fact that you're still here, limping and walking, walking and limping, means that God is not through with you yet. Perhaps your limp has come from an absentee parent or a failed experience somewhere in life. I want to suggest to you, friends, you don't have to be ashamed of your limp. All of us got one. Some are just more visible than the others. But they are tangible reminders that we've been with God and that God has not left us. And it is by that limp that we get to see not our pain, but our value. It's not so much the condition we're in, walking with a limp, so much as it is a conviction that we've been with the one who has all power in his hands. That's why I'm going to take my seat. God bless you. May the Lord God bless you real good. But before I go, let me tell you this. I came to the historic Progressive Baptist Church, and it is an old church. We'll be 100 in about a year and a half, and when I got there, the youngest senior pastor in that church's history, and the predictions were clear. I wasn't going to make it long, is what many had said. But my pastor and some others had given me some sage advice. They said, when you get there, don't change a thing for an entire year. Well, Dr. Ryken, I did my best, but I changed something about the end of that year. We had an old, like this, 8-foot concert grand piano sitting on the platform. It just took up too much space, never really played well. I didn't really want it up there all the time. I like it, but it just didn't work well. But I couldn't move it because some people felt like Jesus had learned to play chopsticks on that piano. And so I couldn't do anything with it. I waited till the middle of the week to take it down to the lower level. We got it moved, and then we start getting it assessed. What would it take to get it fully repaired? And I remember company after company would come in and they would say, oh yeah, we see the conditions it's in. They would study it. They say, but here's what we'll do. We'll take this piano and we'll give you a brand new grand piano, and don't worry about it. We'll take everything from there. After that happened 2 or 3 times, the third time someone offered us not only to give us a new piano, but money on top of the new piano. It occurred to me that they knew something I didn't know about that broke piano. So we decided to call in the people who made the piano. We called in the Steinway Company. Two sleek Caucasian sisters came down to the church, one with a headband on, a little head flashlight on the headband, started looking underneath it, playing it, tinkering with it. Said, oh, it's got good bones. It'll need a new floorboard. Some of the strings need to be replaced. Some of the keys need to be replaced. We need to strip the whole thing, varnish it, and then we can have it back to you. We'll give it to you in a case where you can control the humidity, and it'll play like new for as long as you want it. And I said, well, fantastic. She said, that'll only be these tens of thousands of dollars. To which I replied, well, thank you for coming, but no thank you. We'll keep looking on. She said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, you don't understand. There are other people who are offering us brand new pianos for this one. And money, you want to charge me for this? She said, well, what are they offering you? I started to show her. I couldn't pronounce the name. Kawasaki, Hyundai, Kawai. Didn't know what it was. And she said, no. No, no. And I said, yes. Yes, yes. She said, you cannot do that. I said, well, yes, I can. She said, you don't know what you have here. I said, well, what is it? She said, would you raise the hood for me? I lifted up the hood and embossed in the metal frame was a name. She said, can you read the name? I said, Steinway and Sons. She said, stop right there. She said, sir, we only make 5 of these a year. She said, even in the condition it's in, it's worth far more than that other stuff they're offering you because of the name that's on the inside. I looked at her, I said, thank you, that'll preach for me. And here it is, friends. I don't know where you are. I don't know where you headed. You might have a limp. There may be something broken about you, something that you don't feel like is valuable, but there is a name on the inside of you. And that name gives you value. His name is Jesus Christ. Go in peace.
You've been listening to TGC's Word of the Week. Check back next week for another gospel-centered sermon. We also invite you to visit the resources section of our website, thegospelcoalition.org, to find thousands of sermons to help you understand and apply God's Word.